Hi, I'm Jacob Stein, and this is a presentation on international taxation. So for the next 60 minutes, we will do an overview of both outbound taxation and inbound taxation. I will explain what that means and what we're talking about. So international taxation is a bit of a misleading name because we're not really talking about how Germany or China or any other country taxes a business transaction. We're talking solely about how the United States taxes a business transaction. But we're talking how the United States taxes a business transaction, or really any sort of a transaction, that crosses borders, the transaction that is international in flavor. And we will discuss both outbound transactions. This is where an American goes overseas and does business in another country or invests in another country. And we'll talk about inbound transactions, meaning people coming into the United States, buying real estate, engaging in business, setting up joint ventures, and the like. Okay, so outbound from the United States, inbound in the United States, into the United States. And again, we're talking solely about the United States taxation of these transactions. We're not talking about how other countries tax these transactions. So it's an overview of how the United States treats international cross-border business transactions. So first, we will focus on outbound. So in an outbound transaction, we have an American business or an American individual going overseas to maybe open a bank account, purchase real estate, to purchase investments, or to engage in business. What are the tax consequences in the United States of such a transaction? Well, let's take a look at what will happen if a U.S. taxpayer, an individual U.S. taxpayer, goes overseas to do business. Let's say that I am going to Belgium and I am going to engage in the business of making waffles. On the street, stand on the street corner in Brussels, make waffles and sell them to passerbys. What are the tax consequences of making money having that venture in Brussels? What are the tax consequences in the United States? Well, the tax consequences in the United States are very straightforward. The United States taxes its citizens, taxes its taxpayers on their worldwide income. Meaning, if I'm a U.S. taxpayer, it does not matter whether I generate my income in California or whether I generate my income in Belgium. Wherever I make money, I can make money on the moon. The United States will tax me on that money. Okay? So if I am an individual who is operating a business abroad, there is no opportunity for tax planning. I will be subject to the same tax rules that everyone else in the United States is subject to. If I go to Belgium and I set up a partnership to make and sell waffles, you know, and I'm a partner in a partnership and I have, let's say, a Belgian partner, and the two of us operate this partnership that is making and selling waffles in Brussels. Again, for U.S. tax purposes, whatever my share of the income of the partnership will be, it will flow through to me individually. I will be taxed on it in the United States today and subject to exactly the same rules that all other U.S. taxpayers are subject to. So whenever we go overseas, either as individuals or in a partnership form to do business, there is no special tax planning that takes place, meaning no tax planning that's different from what we would do ordinarily, and there is no opportunity to defer whatever income we generate overseas, because we're taxed on that income today, period, like every other U.S. taxpayer. So the only set of facts where we can change that analysis, the only set of facts where we can say, hey, we are going to go overseas, and whatever money we make there will stay there and will not be taxed in the United States, is when we do business overseas through a foreign corporation. So foreign corporation means that now I am in Belgium, and before I make my waffles and I sell them, I am going to set up a corporation in Belgium. And it will be this corporation that will be engaging in business, that will be selling waffles. So if it's a Belgian corporation that is engaging in business of selling waffles, what are the U.S. tax consequences? Not Belgian tax consequences. I mean, I'm sure Belgium will tax this corporation. We're concerned only with the U.S. tax consequences. Can the United States tax this Belgian corporation? the United States would like to tax this Belgian corporation, solve all kinds of deficit problems for us, right? But it cannot. The United States cannot tax a foreign corporation because this foreign corporation is not doing any business in the United States, which means that the U.S. government has no jurisdiction to tax that foreign entity. So a foreign corporation is the only structure where there is a possibility of deferring tax, so that whatever income is being generated overseas, at least maybe today, is not taxed in the United States. If the foreign corporation itself cannot be taxed by the United States, who can be taxed? Well, only someone that the United States has jurisdiction over. And this would be a shareholder of this corporation who happens to be in the United States. And these shareholders are known as U.S. shareholders. And U.S. meaning both that this is simply someone who lives in the United States. But in another sense, this is a term of art. And the U.S. shareholder refers to a shareholder who owns at least 10% of the corporation. So if we have a Belgian corporation, and I'm one of the shareholders, I'm one of the investors, but I own only 5% interest in this foreign corporation, I am not deemed to be this U.S. shareholder. I am in the United States, but I do not own the 10% or greater interest. And if I am not this U.S. shareholder, I do not need to worry about these special set of rules that apply to taxation of outbound transactions, the rules that are found in subpart F of the Internal Revenue Code. So we're looking at 10% or larger shareholders, these so-called U.S. shareholders, and we are looking for foreign corporations that are controlled by these U.S. shareholders. And then when we have a foreign corporation that is controlled by these 10% or larger shareholders, the tax consequences of the taxable income generated overseas will be felt by these so-called U.S. shareholders. They are the ones that the United States government has jurisdiction over. They are the ones that in some form will pay a tax today on the income that the Belgian corporation generated selling waffles. 10% shareholder must be in control of the foreign corporation. And if the 10% shareholder is in control, or a group of them are in control, then the foreign corporation will be called a controlled foreign corporation. And if we have a foreign corporation that's a controlled foreign corporation, there's a whole set of rules that will apply. It's a very special set of rules with very, you know, negative tax consequences for the U.S. shareholders. So what does control mean? Control means that the U.S. shareholders have to own, in the aggregate, a more than 50% interest in the foreign corporation. More than 50%. Which means that if we have the Belgian corporation and I own a 50% interest and my Belgian partner owns a 50% interest, yes, I'm a U.S. shareholder, but the corporation is not deemed to be a controlled foreign corporation. And if it's not a controlled foreign corporation, we get to close the books and go home early, because this whole separate, you know, set of tax rules that apply to taxation of outbound transactions will not apply to us, because I am not in control of that foreign corporation. These rules that are found in subpart F of the Internal Revenue Code that deal with these controlled foreign corporations are not designed to attach to every single business transaction that takes place overseas. These rules are designed to attach only when a U.S. taxpayer is setting up a foreign corporation for the purpose of deferring tax liability, where tax planning is the primary purpose for having this corporation. So if we're going to look at all of these rules for the next few minutes, and you will see that what these rules test for is, why do we have a foreign corporation? Is it engaging in business? Is it engaging in business in the country that it's organized in? Is it selling in this country, providing some sort of a service in the country, manufacturing a product in the country? You know, why did we set up, let's say, a Belgian corporation? Was it tax avoidance, or was there a real business need? And if we can conclude that there was a real business need, then again, these rules are not designed to apply. Even if I am in control of that foreign corporation, even if I am the sole shareholder of that foreign corporation, if that corporation is overseas for a legitimate business reason, these rules are not designed to apply. So the first part of planning that we do for our clients who go to other countries to engage in business is to see if somehow we can get out of the controlled foreign corporation rules. Because if we can get away from the foreign entity being classified for U.S. tax purposes as a controlled foreign corporation, again, these rules don't apply, we're done. These are very complex rules, very bad tax results, so we really do not want these rules to apply. We want to, you know, get around subpart F of the code. And it's only possible if our client, who is here in the United States, or multiple number of clients here in the United States, are not in control of the foreign corporation. So the question becomes, is the client going to bring in a partner who is going to be overseas? And if that partner owns a 50% interest, at least, right, then my client is not in control, and this is not a controlled foreign corporation. So a lot of the planning is all about how do we structure the ownership of the foreign entity so we can present this foreign entity as not being a controlled foreign corporation. And that's probably the easiest way of defeating the rules if the facts serve us correctly, meaning that we do have these other investors, shareholders we can bring in, or foreigners, and who will defeat the controlled foreign corporation classification. But let's say this is a controlled foreign corporation. Let's say my client is the sole shareholder. What happens then? Well, first of all, what sort of tax benefit? You know, let's assume there is no subpart F. What sort of a tax benefit can a U.S. shareholder get by forming the foreign corporation? Well, as I inferred earlier, if I do have this corporation in Belgium that is manufacturing and selling waffles and making a profit off of selling waffles, the profit cannot be taxed by the United States because the United States does not have jurisdiction over the corporation. And it seems that so long as the profit continues to accumulate outside of the United States, the tax liability that would otherwise be associated with this taxable profit gets deferred until the money is brought back to the United States. So, you know, the U.S. Congress thought it would be an unfair advantage and an unfair tax planning opportunity to allow Americans to set up business operations overseas, make a lot of money overseas, and not pay any taxes on that in the United States. Because if they did the same business operation in the U.S., that would be taxable in the United States. So, subpart F, again, we look for the U.S. shareholder, 10% or greater. We look for a corporation that is controlled. And then we look at what types of income does this corporation generate and what types of activities does this corporation engage in. Well, what types of income? The first and probably the most prevalent category of income that will result in a current tax to the U.S. shareholder is passive income. Passive income means interest, dividends, royalties, rents, gains from sale of property. So if I own a corporation in the Bahamas, and this corporation just has, let's say, a bank account, and the bank account is generating interest income, well, this is passive income, and this passive income will then result in an immediate tax to me, meaning that if in 2013 the Bahamian corporation generates $10,000 of taxable income, then I will be taxed on that income as if I earned that money, as if the corporation did not exist, or as if the corporation paid a dividend to me that is not a qualified dividend, meaning subject to ordinary income tax rates. So with certain types of income, I do not get the benefit of the corporation being a foreign corporation. I don't get to defer the income for tax purposes. I will be taxed on my share of the income today. So if the corporation generated $10,000 of taxable income for the year, and I am a 70% shareholder of this corporation, I will be allocated $7,000 of that income and will be taxed on it today. Ordinary tax rates will apply. Okay? So the first category is passive income. You have a foreign corporation that's generating passive income. The second category is what's called foreign-based company sales income. Wow, very long term. Basically, this is income that the foreign corporation generates from sales, like let's say we're selling waffles, right? It's sales. But when the sale somehow in some way involves a related party in the United States, let me give you kind of an illustration of how U.S. taxpayers used to do business overseas, or what sort of tax planning they used to do. Let's say you are Microsoft and you want to sell Windows 8 in Europe. Well, if Microsoft simply sells Windows 8 to Europe directly, what are the tax consequences? Well, whatever profit Microsoft generates in Europe, the United States will tax Microsoft here in the United States. So Microsoft does the following thing. Microsoft sets up a subsidiary somewhere in Europe, maybe in a low tax or no tax jurisdiction. And instead of selling Windows 8 directly to retailers, Microsoft first sells Windows 8 to its subsidiary in Europe, maybe for a small profit. And then the subsidiary resells the software at a much greater profit. And whatever profit the subsidiary generates is not taxable to Microsoft today. It's in some low tax jurisdiction in Europe, and we'll just accumulate those profits in a foreign country, right? So the idea was that a U.S. business or a U.S. taxpayer would use a foreign corporation as a subsidiary or as a brother or sister company to try to somehow, you know, shelter some of the profits that it could have been generating if it was doing business directly. So this first category of income, the second category of income, the foreign-based company sales income, it looks at the transactions where we have a foreign corporation that sells on behalf of a related party in the United States. So Microsoft's subsidiary would be selling on behalf of Microsoft. It would be buying a product from a related party, from its parent corporation, and then selling elsewhere. So this is a very broad category of income, but there are a lot of exceptions to it. For example, if you recall, I said that these rules will test to see whether you have set up this corporation overseas for a legitimate business reason. What can that be? Microsoft sets up a corporation in Gibraltar, a subsidiary corporation. What is the business purpose of that? Well, is it simply because there is no income tax in Gibraltar? Or is it because in Gibraltar, Microsoft has some sort of a small factory where they actually take the software they receive, then they burn it to disks, and they put labels on disks, and they package it, and then they ship it to Germany and France. Because if the subsidiary actually engages in something meaningful in the country where it's organized, well, then there is a legitimate business reason why we formed the subsidiary in Gibraltar. Or maybe we have a subsidiary in Gibraltar because we're actually selling software in Gibraltar. There are businesses in Gibraltar. People buy Windows 8. So that's a legitimate business purpose for having this corporation in Gibraltar. So the foreign-based company sale rules will apply only if, as part of the sale of the product, we have a related party involved somewhere in the transaction. The subsidiary is buying something from a related party. The foreign corporation is selling something to a related party. And when the sales do not take place, or the manufacture of the product does not take place, in the country where the subsidiary is incorporated. Right? If you have this foreign corporation in Gibraltar, but you are selling products in Germany, well, the question is, why are you in Gibraltar? Shouldn't you have formed a corporation in Germany? Right? So then maybe these rules apply, and you do not get the opportunity to defer your taxable income. Third category of income that, again, the U.S. shareholder will be taxed on currently will be foreign-based company sales income. So again, Microsoft sets up a base in Gibraltar. That's why it's called foreign-based company. This is Microsoft's foreign base. And now the income is being earned in exchange for providing a service. And it's a similar test. Are these services provided on behalf of a related party? Meaning, let's say Microsoft offers warranty services on its products, and now the subsidiary will be providing these warranty services on behalf of Microsoft. And now, again, we look at where are these services provided. Is Microsoft providing these services in Gibraltar through this subsidiary, or is Microsoft providing these services in other countries through its foreign corporate subsidiary? So again, these rules look to see Why was the corporation formed where it was formed? What does it do there? What sort of income does it generate? Passive income, sales income, services income. And is it really income from the country where the entity is organized? As you can imagine, often when people engage in tax planning using offshore entities, what they would like to do is they would like to locate their foreign corporation in a tax haven, right? We want to set it up in the, let's say, British Virgin Islands. There's no income tax in the British Virgin Islands. We want this BVI corporation to generate profits, to generate income, and then take the position, well, then maybe we should not be taxed on that income. Again, the United States cannot tax the BVI corporation because it's a corporation in a foreign country. The BVI will not tax the corporation because BVI does not tax, corporations and income. And then if the corporation and the BVI does not generate these prohibited types of income, then the U.S. shareholder of the BVI corporation will not have to pay tax currently, and the tax liability gets deferred until the money is actually brought back from the British Virgin Islands back to the United States. So I remember about 5 or 6 years ago, there was a news story, kind of a cute, interesting news story. 4 U.S. senators traveled to the Cayman Islands. You guys remember the Cayman Islands? That's what people used to use in the 1980s for offshore planning. That's when we stopped using the Cayman Islands, in case you're wondering. About 5 years ago, 4 U.S. senators traveled to the Cayman Islands to visit an office building. At least that was their excuse, and I'm sure there was some scuba diving involved and such. They visited an office building that was about 5,000 square feet in size, right? Fairly small office building. And this 5,000 square foot building housed the corporate headquarters of 50,000 companies. It's like it's a Harry Potter type of a building. Like you walk in inside and it's just actually humongous. Why would all these companies need to pretend, obviously, that they have these corporate headquarters in the Cayman Islands? And, you know, when you call these companies, there is a receptionist that would answer the phone and say, you know, XYZ distributors, how can I help you? Right? They're trying to create an appearance that they have an office in the Caymans. Why? Well, because they're trying to argue that we incorporated in the Cayman Islands not for the purpose of tax deferral, that we incorporated in the Cayman Islands because, you know, we really are doing something substantive there with our business. We have an office there. Maybe we have staff there. We are providing services in the Cayman Islands, you know, administrative, bookkeeping, what have you. So a part of planning for Americans who go to do business overseas is looking at the business operations, looking at what types of income will be generated, which countries will we be selling in or providing a service in, and how do we then set up a structure so that either we do not generate this prohibited types of income that will result in an immediate tax today, or somehow we fall into one of the exceptions that are available for this income. These rules that govern taxation of shareholders of foreign corporations are exceptionally complex. They're exceptionally complex because there is a lot of room for abuse, right? Because once money is overseas, the Internal Revenue Service cannot levy on that money. It's hard for them to actually physically, practically get that money back into the United States. And it is pretty much impossible for the Internal Revenue Service to somehow audit this company in a meaningful way. Meaning that if you are a U.S. shareholder of a controlled foreign corporation, you will be, you know, filing forms that are attached to your 1040, to your tax return, disclosing all kinds of information about this corporation. But when you do that with a U.S. corporation, if the Internal Revenue Service wanted to verify the information that's on the tax return, it can easily do so, right? It can go to your bank and subpoena corporate bank accounts, verify the balance sheet, to look at the deposits into the account to verify income, to talk to the vendors. But if it's a foreign corporation that banks overseas, the IRS has no ability really, no meaningful ability, to subpoena this information, to independently verify the information that taxpayers provide to them. So as you can imagine, there is a lot of room for abuse. So the rules have to be very complex to get around all of the abuse that at least is perceived as taking place overseas. So, again, when a U.S. taxpayer does business in a foreign country through a corporation, and this corporation is more than 50% owned by 10% or larger shareholders who are in the United States, it is deemed to be a controlled foreign corporation. And once we have a controlled foreign corporation, we look at the types of income the corporation generates to determine whether our U.S. shareholders are taxed on that income today or only sometime in the future when the money is brought back into the United States. Okay? So that's the first kind of sort of general rule for Americans doing business overseas that has to do with these so-called controlled foreign corporations. As you can imagine, this is just a quick review of the rules. I mean, the rules that actually govern taxation of overseas activities are voluminous, really voluminous and very complex. The other basic set of rules that applies to taxation of U.S. activities overseas have to do with what's called a passive foreign investment company, PIFIC. A PIFIC is simply a foreign corporation that is largely passive in nature, meaning that it has mostly passive investments. You know, it's not really engaging in an active business. The most common example would be investing in a foreign mutual fund or investing in a foreign hedge fund, a private equity fund, where our client from the United States simply invests the money, and the money gets managed by someone else. So for our client, this is a passive investment. There's no active business being run. Or the client purchases, let's say, an apartment building in the British Virgin Islands, which is run on a triple net basis. So it's a purely passive investment for the client, cannot be deemed an active business. And if the foreign corporation is deemed to be this passive foreign investment company, doesn't matter what percentage the client owns, it does not matter what percentage is owned from the United States at all. You know, our client can be the only shareholder from the United States holding a 1% interest. Doesn't matter. Our client will not get the opportunity to defer taxable income. And the way that PIFIC rules work is the following. He will not be taxed on the income of the foreign corporation today, meaning the corporation earns money, does not distribute it to our shareholders, so there's no dividend to tax him on. He will not be taxed. What he will have to pay to the IRS, though, today is an interest rate on the tax that is deferred. So basically, our client will not get the advantage of time value of money, of getting the deferral. So if he invested in a mutual fund and the mutual fund generated a lot of revenues and our client's share was $10,000, if the mutual fund distributes the $10,000 to our client here in the United States, our client is taxed on that distribution as a dividend that he received. But if the fund does not distribute the dividend, what the client will have to do is calculate what the tax liability would have been had the $10,000 been distributed to him, and then multiply that liability, that hypothetical liability, by an interest rate. And that is what he pays the IRS today. So he doesn't get the benefit of the deferral. And PIFICs, again, are foreign corporations that are largely passive in nature. So the test is 70% or more of the assets of the foreign corporation are passive assets. Okay. So this is sort of a very basic, very quick summary of the outbound rules. This is when an American goes overseas to do business. Again, if you go as an individual to do business overseas, there is no potential for deferral because you are taxed on your worldwide income. If you invest in a foreign partnership, partnership income will be allocated to you today. There is no potential for deferral. It's only when we do business through a foreign corporation, then maybe we can do some planning depending on how the business can be structured, the ownership of the business, and so forth. So we have finished discussing taxation of controlled foreign corporations. And there is one kind of separate situation for Americans doing business overseas that warrants a closer look. And that is the tax consequence of having an overseas trust. You know, with an American doing business overseas as an individual or through a partnership, we've discussed that deferral is not possible. Only with a corporation is deferral possible. But when you have a foreign trust, it's really not about deferral. Unless the trust is properly structured. It's really now about what qualifies as a foreign trust, what are the reporting requirements, and what sort of planning we can do with a foreign trust. So what is a foreign trust? A foreign trust is simply a trust, usually it's an irrevocable trust, that is governed by the laws of a foreign jurisdiction. So these trusts can be used for any number of reasons. These trusts may be used by foreigners when they have relatives living in the United States and they want to create a trust for the benefit of their relatives in the United States. And there may be very favorable tax consequences if we set up this trust overseas, so it's not subject to U.S. taxation, as opposed to setting up this trust in the United States. It's going to be funded by a foreigner with assets coming from overseas, so very favorable U.S. income tax consequences can be created by using a trust. Foreign trusts can be used for asset protection, right, to protect the assets the trust holds. Foreign trusts can be used for privacy and for a few other reasons. Generally speaking, if you have a foreign trust that is set up by an American, meaning a U.S. taxpayer sets up a foreign trust and transfers assets to this foreign trust, for U.S. income tax purposes, this foreign trust is taxed as a, what's called a grantor trust. And grantor trust means that the trust is completely ignored for income tax purposes. And if the trust is ignored for income tax purposes, no tax planning is possible. The person who set up the trust and transferred assets to the trust will be taxed on whatever income the trust generates. So the trust is completely ignored. The only time we can do tax planning is, again, when a foreigner funds this foreign trust and the assets are kept outside of the United States. Then we can engage in some very clever tax planning. When an American sets up a foreign trust, the only thing he needs to be concerned about is the reporting requirement. And again, anything and everything you do overseas, we'll discuss bank accounts in a second, is subject to very extensive reporting requirements. So for foreign bank account, for foreign trusts, you have to file a Form 3520 and Form 3520A. These forms get attached to your 1040, and they will provide the Internal Revenue Service with all kinds of extensive information on your foreign trust, which jurisdiction it's organized in, who is the trustee, what sort of assets it has, what sort of income it generates, and so on and so forth. So foreign trust can be very clever, very creative, very flexible planning tool in the right set of circumstances, and can actually produce amazing tax results in the right set of circumstances. So in this next section, we will talk about the tax consequences of an American having a foreign bank account. Right? So we've discussed the controlled foreign corporation rules, the income tax rules. Now you do have your business overseas or you're making investments overseas. You need to be able to bank overseas. So you go to a bank and, in Zurich, you open up a bank account, either in your name or in the name of your foreign corporation. What are the tax consequences? Well, the substantive tax consequences of having a foreign bank account are really non-existent. It's just part of your business. It's part of what you do overseas. There is no separate tax that applies to having a foreign bank account. What does apply, though, are the tax reporting requirements that are associated with having a foreign bank account. And as of the past few years, these foreign bank accounts have become subject to very onerous and very exacting reporting requirements. So it used to be that if you have a foreign bank account, you have to disclose it to the United States Treasury. And if you fail to disclose the foreign bank account to the United States Treasury, what happens? Yeah, maybe there is a small penalty. Often it will not apply. It was rarely enforced, and no one really bothered with these rules that much. Plus, people thought, well, listen, I have a bank account in Zurich. No one will ever learn of this bank account. Well, why disclose it? So what started happening a few years ago, you probably have heard of the UBS case, where the United States was able to exercise some leverage over UBS, Union Bank of Switzerland, and get them to start handing over information on all of their U.S. clients. Switzerland failed to protect UBS. The Swiss Parliament sort of caved and told UBS, yeah, you have to provide information, effectively destroying the Swiss banking privacy and secrecy that has existed for hundreds of years. And emboldened by its success, the Internal Revenue Service and the U.S. Treasury started going after banks, other banks and banks in other countries. And later what came out of all of these developments with the UBS is a body of law known as FATCA. And FATCA really, parts of it, small parts of it went into effect this year. The larger, more important parts will go into effect next year. But FATCA provides the following. If you are a foreign bank and you have a U.S. client, you have a choice. You will either provide the Internal Revenue Service with all the information you have on your client, including issuing to the client a 1099 and issuing to the IRS a 1099 on your U.S. client. And if you don't do that, any payment that you receive from the United States will be subject to withholding, very steep withholding. And if you can imagine, if you are a foreign bank, you may want to invest in stocks of U.S. companies, either for yourself or on behalf of your clients, in U.S. bonds, right? Maybe government bonds, what have you. So if the earnings you get from these investments are now subject to very large withholding, that really sort of ties your hands. You don't want that. You want to avoid that. So a lot of foreign banks, even before FATCA, simply because they were concerned with all the burdens that will be coming down the line from the U.S. Treasury, from the United States Securities and Exchange Commission, which has been demanding for years that foreign banks with U.S. clients become SEC compliant, they basically slowly started saying, we don't want U.S. clients. So we went from having literally a few thousand banks in Switzerland alone that would buy for American business to having two banks in Switzerland that will accept a U.S. client. And the same has been happening all over the world. No one wants U.S. clients anymore. Singapore does not want U.S. clients. Hong Kong does not want U.S. clients. Very, very few countries left that willingly take a U.S. person with a bank account. And when FATCA goes into effect, what these banks will have to start doing, the banks that still have U.S. clients, who have maybe not kicked all of them out or who are still accepting business from the United States, is they will have to put together an annual report on all of their U.S. clients, you know, what bank accounts they have, how much money is in the bank account, what sort of earnings they've had for the year in the bank account, and give all of this information to the U.S. Treasury. Or if the country that the bank is in has signed an agreement with the U.S. Treasury, then the bank and the foreign country can provide all of this information to their central bank, which will then hand it over to the U.S. Treasury. So, for example, a lot of the bigger European countries, you know, France, Germany, UK, have entered into these agreements with the U.S. Treasury, so all the UK banks will provide information and U.S. clients to the central bank in London, and then the central bank will provide it to the U.S. Treasury. It doesn't mean that, all of this does not mean that having a foreign bank account is illegal. All of this does not mean that it's a bad idea to have a foreign bank account. And frankly, there's so many U.S. Taxpayers, so many U.S. businesses that engage in business transactions overseas, and they must have bank accounts, right? Not all foreign bank accounts are set up for nefarious reasons. Sometimes it's just, you know, you need a bank account to run your business overseas. But all of this will become to very strict reporting requirements. So we really very strongly urge all of our clients to make sure that they comply with the reporting requirements. Penalties have been very severe as of late. You know, the Internal Revenue Service is now going after undisclosed foreign bank accounts and trying to put people in jail for not disclosing their accounts and income. There was a case I read just a few weeks ago about a woman in her 70s who inherited a foreign bank account from her client. She had it for a few years. She either did not know that she was supposed to disclose it or chose not to, didn't tell her accountants about it. She's now in jail. And it's insane, you know, if you think about that this is happening in the United States, it's, you know, Gestapo at work. But, you know, that is the environment we have today. Anything to do with overseas is immediately and automatically pursued as being aggressive, tax abusive, and subject to very strict reporting requirements. So we do encourage clients to disclose and report anything and everything they do overseas. The second subject that I want to talk about for the remaining 10 minutes is expatriation. And then after expatriation, we will move on to inbound taxation, which is how foreigners are taxed when they come in to the United States and do business in the United States. So what is expatriation? Expatriation is the act of surrendering U.S. citizenship. So why would someone surrender U.S. citizenship? And then, because this is a tax presentation, what are the tax consequences of surrendering U.S. citizenship? Well, the act of surrendering U.S. citizenship is fairly straightforward. You know, you go to the Department of State if you happen to be in the United States, or you go to U.S. consulate or embassy if you happen to be overseas, and there is a process of, you know, handing in your U.S. passport and say, I'm done. I no longer want to be a U.S. citizen. Your citizenship will be torn up, so to speak. Your passport will be destroyed, and you're no longer a U.S. citizen. So we have seen clients who have done this for political reasons. Who was it, I think, the first time Obama was running? No, not Obama. When Bush was running against Kerry, was it Alec Baldwin who promised to move to Mexico if Bush wins? That would have been expatriation if he actually honored his word, but he's still here, but that's a different subject. So we've seen people do this for political reasons. So for example, every time there is an election, we will have clients who come in and say, a Republican got elected, a Democrat got elected, we are fed up with this country, we're moving out. Okay. We've had clients who say, you know, we're so concerned about how there's less and less privacy in the United States and less respect for individual liberties. We want to move to a country where we will have our privacy and liberty. And of course, often people do surrender U.S. citizenship purely for tax planning purposes, which is kind of interesting. So first of all, if you are going to surrender U.S. citizenship, are you going to be like Tom Hanks in that movie, you know, where he's living in the terminal because he doesn't have a passport from any country and he can't cross a border? So before an American surrenders citizenship, before an American expatriates, he has to make certain that he does have a citizenship in some other country, right? So there is a whole now cottage industry that has come into existence to get what's called a second passport, to get a second citizenship. So this would mean that an American would go to a foreign country and usually for some sum of money, purchase citizenship. And you know, when people hear this first time, it sort of shocks them that you can purchase citizenship. Well, the concept and the system of what's called an economic citizenship has been in existence for a long time. It exists in pretty much every single Western European country. It exists in the United States. It exists in most Caribbean nations and many other countries. It's just we don't hear about it commonly, so you know, we're not aware of it. But even in the United States, there is a concept of economic citizenship where a foreigner can come to the United States, invest a certain amount of money, you know, create a certain number of jobs, and he will be given permanent residence and therefore a path to citizenship after 5 years. In the United States, in Western Europe, to gain citizenship, economic citizenship, it's usually a fairly significant investment. I mean, it varies from country to country, but if you want to become a citizen of Italy, you need to invest, you know, from, I think, 500,000 to 1 million euros with an Italian bank for at least a year or 2 years. If you want a Latvian citizenship, it's just a $200,000 acquisition of an apartment in Latvia. But if you want to become a citizen of one of the British Commonwealth jurisdictions in the Caribbean, it's usually fairly inexpensive. And there are jurisdictions where between $150,000 to $250,000, you basically get their passport. What I usually advise my clients when they're trying to pick which country they will buy citizenship from is not to focus solely on the cost. Yes, of course you want to save money, that's understandable. But sometimes you may want to pay a little bit more to get citizenship from a different country. Why? Because this will now become your passport. This will now be the document that will allow you to travel the world. And different countries may have a different amount of visa agreements or no visa travel agreements with countries. So for example, if you maybe get a passport from Angola, there is no other country in the world that will accept you without a visa, and getting a visa and an Angolan passport may not be that easy, right? But if you get a passport from Nevis, let's say, or from Dominica or one of these other countries, you know, these are all British Commonwealth jurisdictions. So right off the bat, every British Commonwealth nation, Canada, UK, Australia, New Zealand, all the Caribbean countries, do not require you to have a visa to travel there. And getting visas to other countries may be actually a bit easier because it's a British Commonwealth jurisdiction. So first part of expatriation is to make certain that the client has that second passport before he surrenders his U.S. passport. Now, the client is ready to surrender U.S. passport. Again, the actual act is fairly simple and straightforward. But before the surrender will be accepted, the client must present to the Department of State a clearance letter from the IRS, where the IRS basically says he paid all his taxes, he can go. Because once someone leaves the United States, the U.S. will have a very difficult time collecting whatever tax liabilities may exist. So they want to make certain that all unpaid taxes have been paid. The expatriation tax regime has been changed in the past 3-4 years. And the new tax regime that is in existence today is what's called a mark-to-market regime. And in the mark-to-market regime, all of the assets that the expatriate owns anywhere in the world are deemed to be sold on the day of expatriation. And if the assets are deemed to be sold, what are the tax consequences? Well, the tax consequences are actually fairly straightforward, right? If you sell an asset, there's a capital gain. You pay capital gain tax on the sale of an asset. If you owned an asset for less than a year, ordinary tax rates would apply. So for clients who are looking to expatriate, the planning can be twofold. One is we want to maybe position them to a place where most assets do not have built-in gains. So over the years, the client converts out of assets with gains into assets that have no gains. Or maybe the assets that will be marked to market today have a lower value than they will have tomorrow. And one of the founders of Facebook, and I always forget his name, engaged in exactly this sort of tax planning. He was a dual citizen, I think, of Singapore and the United States. And before Facebook went public, he surrendered U.S. citizenship. And before Facebook went public, his stock was worth, I don't know, let's say $50 million. I'm just picking a number. After Facebook went public, his $50 million stock was now worth, let's say, $500 million. So if today you surrender citizenship, and today the stock is marked to market, meaning it is deemed sold, it sold at $50 million. He pays the capital gain tax as off of that number, surrenders U.S. citizenship, moves to Singapore, still owns the stock, right? And now when the stock goes public, it's worth a lot more money. And if he sells that stock for a lot more money, it's a capital gain. He is a foreigner. Foreigners are not taxed, as we'll discuss in the next segment, are not taxed on their capital gains from sales of U.S. stock. So expatriation is kind of, it's an interesting process. There's some very interesting pre-planning that can take place for expatriation. And really it is all about what is the value of the assets, how much capital gain do we have, and when do we sell them and how do we get rid of them.
The course code is 547. The course code is 547.
Now let's switch gears entirely and talk about inbound taxation. And inbound taxation is a completely different set of rules. Inbound taxation deals with how foreigners are taxed when they do business in the United States. So let us say that we are representing a client who is Chinese. You know, he's a citizen and a taxpayer in China. He's a resident in China. He does not live in the United States, but he wants to maybe buy real estate in the United States. He may want to enter into a joint venture with an American company to pursue a business opportunity here. So what sort of tax consequences will this Chinese national have in the United States? Meaning, how does the United States tax this Chinese foreign national. Well, the answer, as it usually is, it depends, right? It depends on what he does in the United States, what sort of income he generates, and how he structures his investments. So if our Chinese national is an individual engages in business in the United States will tax him just like it taxes every other U.S. taxpayer, meaning the Chinese national will have to file a tax return in the United States, declare his worldwide income, and will only be taxed on his U.S. income. But the United States requires him to disclose his worldwide income so that all of the expenses and deductions can be properly apportioned between U.S. income and worldwide income. As you can imagine, most foreigners are very reluctant to do that. So, for example, we represent a lot of foreign politicians who may be investing in the United States, you know, Russian oligarchs, wealthy people from South America who are afraid of physical violence like kidnappings. Oftentimes, these people want to keep their affairs as private as possible. The last thing they want to do is to file an income tax return with the United States. And in a lot of these countries where, you know, political systems and government agencies are very corrupt, you know, we have these foreigners who believe that the United States is just as corrupt, and who knows, maybe to some extent we are, and who believe that, yes, they file an income tax return, and for the right price, it will be available to their competitors or whoever. So, you know, usually foreigners do not want to do business in the United States in their name directly, because they do not want to be the one filing a tax return. That problem is usually solved by forming a forming a U.S. corporation for the foreigner, right? So our Chinese national will form, let's say, a corporation in Delaware, or it can form a limited liability company in Delaware that is taxed as a corporation, right? We check the box to tax the LLC as a corporation. And through this entity taxed as a corporation, the business will now be pursued in the United States. And now if you look at who has to file an income tax return in the United States, it's not the individual from China. It's now this Delaware corporation. And the Chinese national is just a shareholder. And being a shareholder in a U.S. corporation, you're not deemed to be doing business in the United States. And if you're not doing business in the United States, there is no requirement to file a tax return in the United States. What if the foreign national is not doing business in the United States? Let's say we have a Russian client who buys simply real estate in California. Well, first of all, even ownership of real estate may be equated to doing business, right? Because this may be actively managed real estate. But even if it's a purely passive investment on a triple net basis, there are certain tax consequences, right? To the extent that the foreign national engages certain types of income in the United States that are not from the operations of a business, whatever income is generated in the United States, it will be taxed to a flat will be taxed with a flat tax of 30%, and the tax is withheld at the time of payment. What does that mean? It means that let me give you a common example. Even with ownership of real estate, our client is an owner of an apartment building in New York City. The apartment building is generating rental revenues, right? Maybe someone is managing the apartment building. So, you know, there's a property management company that is collecting the rent, paying the expenses, and then whatever is left at the end of the day, they want to send it to the Russian who owns this apartment building. Well, they can't simply send 100% of the earnings to the Russian owner of the building. They have to withhold 30%, because now you have a payment that goes to a foreigner that is subject to this 30% tax, again, that is withheld at the time of payment. So if you're a foreigner generating interest income, dividends, rents, royalties, salaries, all kinds of income in the United States, if it's not connected to the operation of a business, this income is taxed at a flat rate of 30%, and the tax is paid at the time you get the money, meaning whoever pays you this interest, dividend, rent, royalty has to withhold 30%. And they will withhold 30%, because if they do not withhold the 30%, guess what? They will be personally liable for the payment of the tax. Okay? There are favorable rules in the United States for foreigners in the following sets of circumstances. Foreigners are not taxed on interest they earn from deposits in U.S. banks. So if you are a German and you open a bank account with Citibank in New York City and the bank account generates interest income, you're not taxed on that interest income. It's a wonderful result for you. So the United States is trying to encourage foreigners to invest in the United States. If you generate a capital gain in the United States, you're not taxed on it. There's an exception for real estate. We'll talk about that in a second. But every other capital gain means you sold an asset and you've generated a gain on the sale of the asset. Shares of stock, furniture, intellectual property, it doesn't matter what the asset is. You sell an asset, you generate a gain, the difference between the sale price and what you originally purchased for, you're not taxed on that difference. U.S. taxpayers are taxed on it. A foreigner would not be taxed on it. And finally, if the foreigner gets paid on what's called a portfolio interest loan, I'll explain what that is. There's no tax and no withholding on this payment. And this is a wonderful planning structure. So a portfolio interest loan is simply a loan that is payable from within the United States to someone overseas. And this loan simply has a provision that provides that the loan payments can only be made outside the United States. So they always have to be directed to a foreigner. They can never be made inside the United States. You know, simple provision. So let's say my client in the United States borrows money from his business partner in Taiwan, and he makes interest payments on the loan. Well, if this is an ordinary loan, every time my client makes an interest payment, guess what? He has to withhold the 30% and pay it over to the Internal Revenue Service. But into the loan agreement, the parties insert this portfolio interest language, which is statutory language, like two sentences, very simple. Withholding is now no longer required because now there is no tax that the foreigner is subject to on the interest income he receives from the United States. So it's absolutely wonderful tax result, and a lot of transactions can try to fit into the portfolio interest rules. Even if it's nothing to do with the loan, you know, we sometimes cleverly try to disguise, you know, equity participation as portfolio interest loan with, let's say, an equity kicker. For real estate, foreigners are subject to a separate tax regime known as FIRPTA. FIRPTA stands for Foreign Investment and Real Property Tax Act. And FIRPTA provides also for a flat tax of 10% on the sale of real estate that must be withheld at the time of the sale. So anytime a foreigner sells real estate in the United States, 10% gets withheld, handed over to the Internal Revenue Service. So that's sort of the basics of how foreigners are taxed in the United States for income tax purposes. But income tax is not all. In the United States, we also have gift taxes, we have estate taxes, cigarette taxes, property taxes, excise taxes, I mean, every kind of tax imaginable. So for foreigners, the other most important types of tax, other than the income tax, will be the gift and the estate tax. So the estate tax applies if a foreigner owns assets in the United States and then he dies. And the estate tax is imposed on the assets passing to the heirs, to the younger generation. Right? So let's say our client from France bought a home in Los Angeles, and the home is in his name. He dies in France. He lives in France. He's never actually been to the United States. He dies in France and leaves this home to his child, who also lives in France. We don't know why he bought this home, but that's not important. He has an asset in the United States. Well, the U.S. estate tax will apply to the transfer of the home from the parent to the child. And the estate tax will apply at the rate of 40%, meaning 40% of the value of the home will now go to the U.S. government. U.S. taxpayers are able to exclude from the estate tax $5 million of assets, meaning I can leave to my child $5 million before the 40% tax applies. Foreigners don't get that exclusion. They get to exclude only the first $60,000 of what they leave to their heirs. So if we have foreign clients who own assets in the United States, we do not want them to own these assets in their name directly. Because if they own assets in the United States in their name directly, on death, the assets will be subject to the estate tax. So in a case like this, what we want to do is we want our foreign client first to form a corporation overseas. And through this overseas corporation, to own the real estate in the United States, to own the limited liability company in the United States, to own whatever it is he will own in the United States. Because if he owns these assets through a foreign corporation, a non-U.S. corporation, then when he dies, what is the asset that he owns? Well, it's a share of stock in a foreign entity. It's not subject to U.S. taxation, not subject to U.S. estate tax. So it's a very simple way for a foreigner to defeat the application of the U.S. estate tax. There's a lot to planning for foreign investment in the United States. There are probably 12 to 15 structuring combinations that are commonly used. You know, does the foreigner own assets directly? Sometimes, maybe that's a good idea. Through a corporation, through an LLC, is there a foreign entity? Does the foreign entity own the U.S. entity? And so on and so forth. There's many different permutations of how that is structured. There are several other types of tax that apply specifically to foreigners when they invest in the United States, like the branch profits tax, a very onerous tax that we really want to plan around. So, you know, the basic rule that I want you to carry out today, both for outbound and inbound taxation, is that you get some very amazing results whenever you engage in income tax planning for cross-border transactions. You just need to plan a bit in advance. With some proper pre-planning, you can get very amazing results. You can get tax deferral if you're an American investing in the United States. And if you're a foreigner investing in the United States, there are many ways to avoid tax withholding, to avoid the application of the estate tax and minimize your income tax exposure, to keep your privacy and liability protection. If you guys have questions about this presentation, about the subject of the presentation, you should be getting a very substantive handout with the presentation. But I'm always happy to answer questions. Please feel free to call me. Feel free to email me. My contact information should be in the outline. But if you don't have it, my email address is jacob@lataxlawyers.com. Jacob, J-A-C-O-B, at L-A, like Los Angeles, tax, T-A-X, lawyers.com. Thank you for listening, and I hope you've enjoyed it.